September 8th, 2020, meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in this morning, and in the spirit of social distancing due to COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted by telephone. Members of the public that may be on the phone are encouraged to make comment and ask questions during our business session. If you do wish to speak, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. I will open our phone lines to the public for such comment during the business session later today. This morning's meeting is a study session. While our business session typically starts at 1 o'clock, due to the light morning agenda, we will be trying to get to the business session meeting before lunch today. Today we have all five commissioners on the phone. General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Rebecca Garfin, Clerk of the Board, are in the boardroom. So at this time, if you would please join us, Cassie Bertelson is with us and will be giving us the HPI moment. And Cassie, perhaps you'd also be willing to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance this morning.
Absolutely. Thanks for the introduction. All right, if everybody's ready, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you all. So good morning. As mentioned, I'm Cassie Bertelson, Senior Safety and HBI Coordinator, recently transferred over from the Internal Audit Department, and I appreciate you having me here to present the HBI Safety Minute today. So as many of you likely heard, on Thursday morning, August 27th, a Harbor Freight semi-trailer was departing the Rock Island Dam on the Douglas County side after completing a delivery drop-off at the dam's warehouse. With no space to be able to turn around, the delivery driver backed the semi along the spur track in parallel with the train tracks until reaching the crossing intersection. He then proceeded to cross the tracks at a diagonal position when the safety lights began to flash and the crossarm warning gates lowered into position both in front and behind him. The driver briefly attempted to reangle the semi in an effort to avoid hitting the safety gate in front of him. However, prior to the truck clearing the crossing, it was struck by a BNSF train near the rear axle, severely damaging the trailer. Fortunately, no one was injured. So even though this particular incident involved a delivery driver at a railway crossing owned and controlled by BNSF, it presented a significant learning opportunity through which our own district defenses can be improved around the crossing area to protect others and ourselves. So how exactly do our five HPI principles relate to this train crossing incident? First, we're all human, and it's a fact that we all make errors. Just like the delivery driver in this instance, I'm sure anyone on this call can think of at least one, if not several, previous errors in judgment made while driving. Second, it has been proven that our human-prone errors follow a recurring pattern, which makes them both predictable and manageable. At this specific Rock Island Railroad crossing, there have been three previous minor incidents noted, and potentially even more situations that have gone unreported. Third, we must tap into our curiosity, which drives us to continue learning. Having discovered that several incidents had happened previously at this train crossing location, it solidified the fact that these errors were following a recurring pattern which should be further explored. Fourth, as humans and employees, we are not the problem. Instead, employees are typically able to provide the best solutions because they know the work and its issues. Hence, teams of safety and Rock Island staff were gathered to analyze the incident and the crossing area to better understand what it is about the way that we are that contributed to this and the other previous incidents. And fifth, it's key to remember that true safety excellence is not the absence of failure, but the presence of process and defenses. Therefore, we can consider this and the previous non-injury incidents at this railway crossing lucky. But more importantly, we've deemed it an opportunity to thoroughly learn and take necessary action to improve our defenses and prevent any similar recurrences in the future. Therefore, the district is in the process of creating specific work order actions for the following recommendations. A designated backing area will be delineated and painted to provide space for large vehicles such as delivery semi-trailers to turn around. The physical driving area surrounding the railroad crossing section have been analyzed and potential expansion improvements which would provide large vehicles with approximately an 80-foot clearance approach to the railway gates. Warning signs will be posted and stop will be painted on both sides of the crossing to advise drivers to take extra precaution on and around the tracks. Also, district staff have begun assessing the risk at other district crossings in order to decrease additional railway hazards. So on a final note, be sure to keep a questioning attitude and be situationally aware. Remember to keep going once you've begun crossing the tracks, even if the warning lights start and the arms come down. Those safety gates are designed to break away and are much cheaper to repair than the alternative damage to you, your vehicle, or the train. Thanks again for having me, and stay safe.
Boy, Cassie, that was a great presentation.
Thank you.
And so very true. When you called me out, basically, and I think maybe others as well, several times, and I've been driving and probably did silly things that I shouldn't have, looking back on them. So this is very timely, especially during the Labor Day weekend just passing. So thank you.
I would just like to say thank you to Cassie as well, because I thought she did a great job of connecting how HBI can be used in the real world to be able to help us to become better at safety and operational excellence. So, really good job, Cassie. There are no other comments. I think we're ready to move to the approval of the agenda.
All right. Now, commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us. Items on the agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Do I hear any such request? Hearing no such request, all those in favor of the current agenda, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Pardon, there should be a motion first. Is there a motion to accept the consent agenda?
I'll make that motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 And those opposed, say no. The ayes have it. So, Steve, I think we're ready to move on to the next item on the agenda, which I show as public power benefit project updates.
Yeah, the board will recall that in the last two board meetings, we've discussed the potential acceleration of the fiber broadband expansion program. But one of the things that we wanted to do for before bringing that to a conclusion was to put it in the context of our overall public power benefit spending and make sure that we had a good communication with the board about what the implications will be, because we'll be pulling dollars forward. That means more dollars spent in the PPB program the next few years, less dollars available for other programs. So Felicity Saberhagen is here today to provide that presentation for you.
Good morning. Felicity Saberhagen, business manager, here, as Steve mentioned, to talk about how we're going to consider our options we have to consider funding the fiber acceleration program through the 2020 and 2021 a funding period. Sorry, my computer's a little touchy when I move this, so if I'm moving around here, I apologize. What we're looking at is presenting an option to fully fund the accelerated fiber program and what that might look like. And to help the board make an informed decision, we'll look at how the funding acceleration affects the public power benefit program over the remainder of the strategic planning cycle. We'll also be looking to the board for support to formally allocate public power benefit funding to the community response of COVID-19. There's no specific board action today, but we are looking to the board for confirmation that we are on the right path. So what do we need to consider in order to fund fiber acceleration? Throughout the public power benefit program, we've typically funded the build out and connections of fiber expansion before the projects have begun. If we were to take this action right now, that would fully utilize all available funding in 2020 and 2021. In recognition that new projects may be coming forward for board consideration, we had a goal to preserve funding so the board could respond to any new project requests. Our recommendation is to fund fiber build-out in 2020 and 2021 and wait until 2022 to fund the connections. This does more closely align with how cash flow and how contracts would actually work, so it is a reasonable recommendation to consider deviating from our past practice. So how does that look in 2020, and what do the details look like? Let's take a look. In 2020, we have already allocated $4 million of the $6 million program funding. This includes $2.5 million for our planned fiber expansion and $1.5 million for the Peshkadin wastewater treatment plant. We're proposing that an additional $1.8 million be allocated for fiber acceleration. For the remaining $200,000 in this funding period, we would like to consider support for the community response to COVID-19. This would fully allocate all 2020 funding in the program, which is great because we are coming up toward year end. In 2021 funding period, we had held off allocating any projects until we knew more about fiber acceleration and what that might cost. With that information now available, we would like to request $1.5 million for the expansion of an addition and an additional $3.7 million for the acceleration of our expansion program. This would still leave $800,000 to fund new project requests that may come forward for board consideration. I believe this is reasonable to fund smaller projects or studies and to evaluate larger projects, especially given that we'll be back in spring of 2022 for consideration of funding in 2022. So you might be asking, how does this impact our ongoing projects funded through PPD? Let's take a look at the projects we have underway. There are 8 projects in the works. In addition to fiber expansion, we have the Horan Area Rehab, Jobs and Work Readiness, Rocky Reach Discovery Center, the Museum Story, the Loop Trail Extension at the new Service Center, and continued funding of Day Use Park Passes, as well as the Peshkadin Wastewater Treatment Plant that are all currently started or currently funded through our program.
May I interrupt? This is Ann. What was the second one that you mentioned that's been funded?
The Horan Area Rehab, the rehabilitation of that area, and we're still waiting on some studies and working with an adjacent property owner in order to advance that project.
Maybe it was the third one then. Maybe it was the third.
Jobs and Work Readiness?
What is that?
The job and please. I'm sorry?
I couldn't understand. What was that one again?
So Jobs and Work Readiness is the one where we're funding outreach with the community in terms of making education available, partnering with the Wenatchee Valley College to bring forward the engineering program. In addition to that, that also incorporates the supported employment program.
And what dollar number is attached to that?
So right now we have funded $172,000 from the original funding period. Only $87,000 of that has been spent, and there's still $85,000 remaining to continue funding that project or that program.
Good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Was there another question? I thought I heard someone try to speak.
Yeah, that was me, Felicity. I just wanted to make sure Commissioner Cotton knew that the supported program is the program for disabled folks that that she has expressed so much interest in.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Appreciate that.
So one of the things in looking at our projects, we wanted to know Are we going to jeopardize any of the projects that we have going forward? And I think probably, Ann, that was, Commissioner Congdon, that was part of your question. So in looking at what our forecast for requests for supporting our ongoing programs are, as you can see, if I can scroll down just a little bit in this slide, our total requests for our programs in the current years, in the years in the strategic planning cycle, do not exceed the $6 million. So we do have money available to continue funding new projects and programs as they might come forward.
Thanks. This is really helpful. Appreciate it.
An additional question?
Yes, Commissioner Smith.
On the fiber expansion for this year, and I believe I've asked this before, but I just want confirmation, that in all likelihood, most of that would be spent with a contractor, or would it as an additional acceleration?
So I believe what the acceleration, in order to be able to accommodate that, we're going to incorporate more contracted work than we have in the past. I'm not exactly sure how that splits out between the two. If you'd like some additional information, I'd be happy to get that for you going forward.
Yeah, I think I can add to that and just say it's unlikely that we would be able to spend a lot of that on contractors this year because we'll need to put a new contract in place. We are looking at whether we can use some of our existing contracts with dock crews to be able to do a portion of that work, but we're not complete in terms of making that determination. So what we're really doing is setting up an expectation here that that we know that we will be using more contractors and that we may be entering into contracts this year to get that work started, and then but the bulk of the work will be occurring in succeeding years.
Yeah, it just seems like that 1.8 is a pretty aggressive number for the balance of this year.
Yeah, I think what we're thinking about is entering into contracts as opposed to actually completing the work and having the cash flow out of the organization.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, thank you. That when we fund the projects, they don't necessarily mean the spending will occur in that year, so that could happen throughout the next couple of years. The build-out, for example, as Steve mentioned, we would be entering into the contracts over this year and next year, and then the build-out would be happening over the next couple of years.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Commissioner Smith, does that answer your question, or do we have a follow-up action item there?
No, that answers my question.
Thanks.
This is Commissioner Arson. I have a question. Will this then have an impact that will result in a pause for future public power benefit dollars in future years, since this would be allocated most likely to 2021 and beyond?
Commissioner Arson, no, this would not necessitate a pause in the program. We would still have just about between 3 and 4 million available in 2022, 23, and 2024, even after funding the full program of fiber and acceleration.
So I guess my question wasn't a pause necessarily of the fiber program, but a pause in additional public power dollars being allocated until we caught up with the spending.
I think maybe the best way to answer that is to say that we believe that we can fund all of the activities that have previously been discussed with the board, still have a very small amount of room in 2020, but to be honest, it's not very much because we've committed COVID-19 dollars that will mostly eat up that $200,000 that's left there. That there's about $800,000 worth of room in 2021 for things that are not currently funded. So there's a modest amount of money. In the past, we've usually walked into the year with about $1.5 million or so available because we were operating at the $4 million level. So we'll have a little less than what we've had in previous years as we walk into a year. And then in the succeeding years after 2021, there's actually more money left than there has been in previous years.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve. That was really my question. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
And Commissioner Arsenault, we will be back in spring of 2021 to look at funding for 2022. So there's a pretty short window that we're trying to cover in terms of making funds available for additional project requests.
Thank you.
So in summary, we can fund the acceleration of fiber by funding build-out in 2020 and 2021, but we would need to fund connections in 2022. This would still allow, as we've been discussing, the board to reserve funding for quick hit projects or studies out of the 2021 funding period. And so what we're looking for right now is just really, are we on the right track with board expectations regarding the public power benefit program? And are there any additional questions that you might have?
And I'm going to put a finer point on that, if I could. I think what we would like to do at this point is seek the head nod support from the board for moving forward with the fiber acceleration program based on the previous presentations about what the cost of that program could be and our ability to accelerate roughly 1,300 homes into this current time period through 2024. Now, I'm going to caveat that with I've been having conversations with our general counsel, and the original board authorization for the fiber expansion program was for a total of $25 million. And so we now would be looking at $27 million. And so he believes that technically we should have a resolution from the board to take us from the 25 to $27 million. But that's not necessary at this time. We could bring it forward at a future point in time. And we'd like to go ahead and get started with this to have the board's commitment that this is the right action to take. So we've already begun work on contracts, et cetera. We'd like to know that there's board support for that. So two-part action. Today we'd be looking for a head nod to support the fiber acceleration activities that, as I say, have been presented to the board in previous meetings. And then at some point in the future, we are going to bring forward the formal resolution to change the $25 million to $27 million. And if you were in the room, you could see Eric nodding his head in agreement to that.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm nodding my head. This is Ken.
Okay.
This is Steve McKenna. I'm nodding my head as well. I think if we look at the times, particularly, we can see that there's just more and more need than ever for these connections, and I certainly am supportive.
This is Dennis. I would say proceed, please.
Yes, please proceed, yes.
And Gary here, I'm in agreement.
Great. Thank you. That's what we needed for today, and we appreciate your guidance on this. I do think this is an important item. We said before, this is the item that received the most comments in our strategic planning process to try to find ways to move forward with fiber acceleration, and we feel like it's taken a while to get here, to be honest, to come up with a plan that we think we can implement, but we think we're there now. With that, unless there's a question, I thought I might have heard a voice, we are ready to move to the next item.
Thank you, Commissioners. I appreciate your time today and the direction as well.
Thanks, Felicity.
Okay, next up is an update on the OME substation project. Chad Rissman will be presenting.
Good morning, Commissioners. Chad Rissman, Distribution and Asset Management. Hope everybody's doing well. Purpose of the presentation today is provide some background and then ultimately a request. Here, a proposed motion is drafted at the end of the presentation to increase the total project authorization for the OME substation construction by $1.04 million for a total project budget of $6.4 roughly $6.9 million, just under $7 million. The additional project expense is not anticipated until 2021. Thus, there's no change to the 2020 budget, providing us some opportunity to make some adjustments. So we're at a point in the project where we're just going to construction, all the procurement and things are done. And so we're reinforming the project schedule and reinforming the project total budget and authorization, and we're recognizing that there's some changes that we need to make there. So a little bit more background on that. The OMI substation is a project that we're building out in the old station area. It replaces our old station substation that is a 28-megawatt station. It is rated as our lowest condition substation due to its age and testing, electrical and oil testing on the equipment, and so it's scheduled and slated for replacement. In addition, there is additional capacity in the area that has been requested and built, namely the expansion. It's a really critical and important area for Chelan County. It's probably the industrial hub, so ensuring that there are reliable services for this area is important to all of us. We're planning on double banking this station, so that will provide us the additional 28 megawatts of capacity. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Next slide, please. So the additional project authorization and budget request for this project, I had mentioned that design and procurement is completed and finalized. So we have actual costs related to all the equipment and also to the labor contract. So design and all those things are completed, so we can reinform our project to where we anticipate the total expenses to be. So we're recommending to revise the project in the project authorization and budget increase by 17%, or this $1.04 million. So as I mentioned, we're requesting a motion. We'll have some suggestions of that in the end. Next slide, please. Where is the increases coming from? So construction contract is the primary labor contract associated with constructing the substation. The increase of about almost $1 million, $945,000. So there's three specific items there that we recognize were lower than anticipated in our estimate. Need to increase in these areas. So one was the soil resistivity of the station. It means it's fairly rocky out there, and we were going to have to put in more ground grid than we anticipated. So there's drilling in several wells, ground wells, that was not anticipated, and that's increasing the contract. Our last substation that we constructed completely was in 2012. We did a rebuild in Cashmere in 2015. And we've seen a higher escalation than we had estimated, since our estimates were based off of previous contracts. And then as a result of the double banking, there's some increases there related to district staff, construction management, project management. And then we've received some of the equipment and materials that you'll see later on in a picture here in the presentation. We had to create some temporary storage for those, so there was some additional expenses there. Next slide, please. So I wanted to get into a little bit of the background of the substation. When we first outlined the substation, we were considering a single bank or a single 28-megawatt station just to replace the old station. Substation, the existing station, and then we started receiving requests and looking out into the future, it looked like there was some additional capacity that was going to be required, so we started exploring the idea of a double bank. We also revised our standards to pursue lands that would be adequate to accommodate a double bank plus the mobile substation for future stations and that we budget and estimate for. So even though we may only propose to build out the single bank, we recommended and we presented to the board that we wanted to acquire additional property such that in the future we would be able to double bank. So we can evaluate whether or not we wanted to do that sooner or later, double bank them, but it provided us the opportunity. So in April 2019, when we recommended double banking, we also increased the budget estimate to what it currently is from 3.7 to what it currently is to 5.9 million. So a total revised project estimate is just under $7 million, rounded number. Next slide, please. I talked a little bit about our substation standard. This is not actually a substation. It's a photoshopped photo here of what a double banked station looked like. It's essentially a twin within one physical yard. We have a couple of these in the district, but none of them were constructed at the same time. They were built over time. So there's efficiency gains that we can get by placing two stations on one physical yard. So we developed out our substation standard to accommodate what, instead of a 28 megawatt station that ultimately, given the choice, we could move to a 56 megawatt, which is 228 megawatts. Next slide, please. In April of 2019, we made the recommendation to double bank the OMI substation. We identified through the design that some additional property was going to be required in order to accommodate that double bank construction. So we brought to the board and made a recommendation that we add an additional 40 feet. We worked with the adjacent property owner and were able to acquire that additional property. I'll point out there's a street light that's a vertical black line in there as a point of reference. And so we removed that retaining wall and moved it back closer to where that red dash line is. So if we advance to the next slide and you look at that area light there, you can see as a reference that wall has already been constructed and the additional property has been acquired and the station and excavation and dirt work has been completed. Also want to note in this, I mentioned earlier that we've received some of the equipment, so we're a bit ahead of the construction portion of that, but we've received the two of the power transformers you can see that are sitting there, and then some of the circuit breakers and other electrical equipment. So we've taken delivery of some of the equipment. Next slide, please. A little bit more on the construction schedule. So we're expecting September 11th to receive the conditional use permit, so that finalizes the permitting. We have opened up the bids on the construction contract and would like to award, but do not want to award unless we receive the authorization. So we want to make sure that a project budget is trued up for what we expect the final expenses to be. So we're anticipating September 28th. To award the construction contract. Notice to proceed will follow 10 days from that award. In the contract, we're looking for foundations or concrete work to be, for the most part, completed by somewhere around Thanksgiving, a foundation 10 weeks from award, so around Thanksgiving, and then all concrete work to be completed by the end of December. So hopefully we're not into too cold weather, although it will be getting cold. Takes more work to put together concrete structures in the cold. The switchgear, the two switchgear lineups will be here on or around March 15th of 2021. So having all the subgrade and concrete work completed and ready for the switchgear to arrive to be sat on there is part of the contract schedule, and then construction should be largely completed by the contract in May, which then commissioning, testing, and energizing will follow into July. Next slide, please. I wanted to mention 2019 and 2020 has been a pretty big lift for our substation project. As I mentioned, we haven't built a new substation since 2012, and we wanted to make several standard changes. I mentioned a few of those, the capability to double bank. As a result of making those changes, a significant number of our standards had to change, so there was a greater lift than anticipated to incorporate those changes into our standards. So that was quite a bit of work. We also, in the contract, we've got the ability to purchase additional power transformers, and the contract for power transformers, that's a 12 to 16 month lead time on those transformers, so knowing when those deliveries, having the delivery pinned down and the cost pinned down of those will be good for accelerating these projects in the future, stations in the future. General arrangement completed and property purchased. So the next three stations, Bavarian, North Shore, and Wenatchee, property is already purchased. The general arrangement is the physical layout of the yard and how that's going to fit the site. We usually call that a 30% design, and that is completed for those next three stations. We have a significant amount of the design work, and that was a pretty big lift over the last 18 months. We also have some lessons learned on critical paths items. There are several critical paths that we encountered, and we've developed mitigations for those. A lot of that is around communications to other stakeholders and groups and internal and external contractors to ensure that the next delivery milestone is well understood and scheduled and that people know what their roles are. So that was a big lesson learned that's been incorporated in the go forward. And then I've mentioned this a couple of times. So all of the contracts, since we've essentially completed with all the contracts, both equipment and labor contract and the design for the design phase and the procurement phases, all those contracts now that have been incorporated, the newest standards are repeatable. So in these future stations, we'll be able to take those, not exactly cookie cutter, because there's accommodations that need to be made for the yard and the layout and the general arrangements. But much of the contracts can be repeated and put into the next contract. So looking forward to accelerating our schedule. Next slide. Lessons learned on double bank. One of the areas that we have had some discussions on, recommendations obviously for this station to double bank for the purpose of capacity. Excuse me, we considered double banking for the future stations, specifically in North Shore Chelan where the growth is high. Well, we expected and anticipated to get a larger economies of scale since they're essentially kind of doubling. We felt that we would get somewhere closer to 50% economies of scale, and as it turns out, with our experiences here, our economies of scale for double banking is actually about a 20%. So we want to use that understanding and that lessons learned to re-inform decision-making about when we would do timing for additional capacity. We want to make sure that capacity that is purchased is going to be utilized sooner than later. We don't want to have capacity that we're maintaining and station capacity that we're maintaining and it's not utilized and there's not a revenue stream associated with it. So we'll use that to reinform our decisions going forward about double banking. Next slide, please. Some draft language on the motion. So we're requesting requesting a motion to increase the total project budget for the OMI substation project. Project number stated there by $1.04 million for a revised total project budget of $6.969053. The additional project expense is not anticipated until 2020, thus no change to the 2020 distribution capital budget is required. So I do want to mention that if the commissioners prefer, this can be delayed till the next. This motion can be delayed till the next commission meeting without a significant impact to the project schedule. With that, are there any questions?
Commissioners, are there any questions for Chad?
Yes, I have one.
Go ahead.
I actually have a couple of questions. It was a good presentation, Chad. Good understanding delivered the fact that we haven't built a substation in 8 years. There's some things change in 8 years, obviously. I'm hoping, and you can address this, if not, that since we're building so many substations in the next few years, that we may see some cost savings over this substation in our upcoming new build based on what you shared with us, and that could be a good thing. The question that I have relates to the substation that will be no longer in use. We probably talked about it, but I do not recall. What becomes of that piece of property once we cease operations on it down at an old station?
That's a great question. Some of our stations were owned by permit. Some of them we own the property. So once the equipment is decommissioned and we've had an evaluation, an environmental evaluation of the site and ensured that we've removed any concrete or any hazards or anything like that, then what we'll make a recommendation to surplus the property. So the property would be surplused. An example recently is Simmer Substation in Kashmir. A part of the Kashmir purchase agreement that property is adjacent to a park there in Kashmir. And so part of that agreement was that property would refer back to the city. There was another one, Blue Star Substation, where we decommissioned and vacated that property, and that property was adjacent to Blue Star Growers, so that went that referred back to them, part of that agreement. So specifically an old station, I don't recall if we own that property, if the PUD owns that property or not, but we would recommend surplusing that, and then we would go through that process.
Thank you.
I wanted to mention, too, your other question about cost reductions for future. I believe that with the contracts that we've already put out, we'll be able to repeat those. We should see some cost savings there. Also on the design side, we should see some reductions on the design side since we have examples to be able to build off of. We had to redo our standard design, so we should be able to see some efficiency gains and some cost reduction gains in those areas too.
Thank you.
Chad, this is Dennis. What is the service footprint for the OMI substation? What territory total is that going to, being double banked, will it be able to serve?
Great question, Commissioner Bowles. Thank you. So right now it serves pretty much down to Penny Road and then up to Rocky Reach Dam. So that whole industrial area, and we're going to expand that over into the OMI Road. So as a part of another project, we're going to be increasing the size of the distribution cables in that area. So we're going to extend the service area of the existing Old Station footprint. So there's been some growth within there, namely the mill we talked about. Then we're also going to push the boundaries of that out further. In lighter load times, we'll be able to provide a backup to a Sunny Slope substation too. So during lighter load times, it'll be supportive of Sunny Slope and Rocky Reach substation.
Yeah, that was actually not said and embedded in part of the question, because it looks like the Sunny Slope substation has been there quite a while and has to be with all the residential construction beginning to push its limitations, and I thought perhaps it would add some redundancy in its capacity there.
Absolutely.
Okay, second question is, it seems like to me there's been some discussion on the viability of double banking versus single banking, but more substations. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it seems like to me if you double bank on get a little bit larger piece of real estate, that's a more feasible approach than it is to single bank on multiple pieces of property. Could you enlighten me a bit on that, please?
Well, I like your thought process there, and I think we're thinking the same thing. It's more of having a few larger stations than many smaller stations. So trying to best utilize and consolidate utility infrastructure to use less and less real estate also means that, you know, that particular real estate needs to be a little bit bigger. As I mentioned in the presentation, we anticipated that we would get a greater economies of scale than what we're actually seeing with OMI substation, but that is the intent there, is to try to consolidate the utility infrastructure and to gain some economies of scale.
Okay, so it could be a model then for other future substations, possibly double banked on a little bit larger piece of property rather than multiple pieces of property.
Yeah, and the other option, in addition to that, the other option is to be able to, the other option would be to look at property that was adequate to put two banks on, but only build one at the time and let growth occur in the area and then be able to build that. So we were contemplating making recommendations to build double banking sooner than what the capacity was needed at the time. But based on the results and the economies of scale that we're seeing here at OMI, I think we're revisiting that recommendation.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's in line with the thinking that adequate location and property acquisition is becoming more scarce. And that the sooner we move on, you know, perhaps real estate that accommodates future growth and tie that up and notify the public that it's PUD property for future, we might be better off in our long-term thinking.
We appreciate the board's support and the community's support for doing exactly that, identifying our long-range plans are pretty good at identifying where a substation or utility infrastructure will be required. It's not quite as good as knowing when, but if we can identify the location and move on the property acquisition with the support of the community and customers and the board, then we can reduce the possibility that we would have to shoehorn in a substation somewhere and be more consistent with our standard. And as built out occurs, our customers in that area and the community around would understand that that infrastructure would be located there, which would help inform their decision making on what and how and where they were going to build also.
Well,
thank you for bringing that up, Commissioner Bull.
Yeah, I don't think the concept of not in my backyard is going to go away anytime soon. So the fewer conflicts we have with the community, community in terms of locating substations. I think the sooner we can tie that up, the better off we're going to be.
Yeah, this is Gary, and I just had a question in terms of future economy of scale and the ability to increase that benefit. Would it be fair to say that as part of the analysis of potential subsite locations is to take a look at the soil? I know that we had to, in terms of moving that wall back, the soil mitigation was a fairly expensive process. And then in terms of the soil stabilization, it sounds like that also contributed to a lower economy of scale. So is that something that's being, that was one of the lessons learned that we're sort of evaluating for future locations where we want to double bank?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I think in addition to that, there's some permitting, some additional design work to really pin down the permitting and to pin down the actual property, doing some soil investigations to get a better understanding of what the project estimates and variables are. So some of those critical paths items that we've learned here now in this station, we can definitely apply those in the future. So thank you for pointing that out.
Cool. No, thank you.
Are we looking for a motion on this today?
Commissioners, I think that they are asking for a motion today. This is Eric. Sorry about that. But if the board's inclined, waiting won't delay the project. The reason I'm answering that question probably is that I think the motion proposed is fine. I think you can eliminate the last sentence, which is good background information but not necessary to the action. If the board is inclined to make a motion, that first sentence is all you need.
Thank you, Eric. Commissioners, what are your wishes?
Commissioner Arsenault, I propose a motion to increase the total project budget for the Ohme Substation Project DS170006 by $1.04002 revised total project budget of $6,969,053.
Thank you, Commissioner Bolts. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Thank you, Commissioner Smith. There's been a proposal and a second on a motion. Do we have any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it. Thank you, Chad. Great presentation.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Commissioners.
Gary, this is Steve McKenna. Can I ask a question before Chad leaves?
Yes, please, go ahead.
So one of the curiosities that I have is if the need for double banking out at Ohme is high, is there some benefit, or I guess my question is, instead of either selling or turning back Ohme property, is there, even 20 years down the road, is there some thinking that it would be wise to hang on to that property if an additional substation were needed in the future in that area? Or is there a confidence level that that's not going to be needed?
There is a confidence level that that's not going to be needed. It's not looking like that in our at least 20-year plan. The additional work, I think, does need to be done in order to understand exactly what we would recommend with that property and whether surplusing would be in the best interest of the district. There's also other utilities water, wastewater, fiber, other utilities or operations of the district that we usually go through a process and make sure that those properties aren't something that would be helpful or useful for one of the other utilities. So definitely more work, Commissioner McKenna, about what the final recommendation would be at that property, but at least in the next 20 years, it's not expected to provide a use from an electrical distribution standpoint.
Great. Thank you, Chad.
So, Steve, we're at that point where it's still early in the morning. Would you like to move on to the business session?
I would like to suggest that we do that, and that would also the first item, or after the consent agenda, the first item was one that Chad's involved in, so we could also hopefully use his time wisely as well.
Okay. Well, thank you. So, commissioners, let's move on to the consent agenda. There's a motion. Is there a motion to accept the consent agenda?
I would move that we accept the consent agenda.
So it's been moved, and did I hear a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Rebecca, did you get the names of who moved it and second?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear who seconded.
I think that was Steve.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Rebecca. Thank you, Steve. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of accepting the consent agenda, please say aye.
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 And those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it. Now, Steve, I'll turn this over to you.
Okay, so agenda item 7 is a resolution for approval of field work order change order number 3 to contract 17-78 with Kemp West Incorporated for 2018 to 2020. District tree trimming, as I mentioned earlier, this is implementation of our strategic plan as we seek to try to move into top quartile for distribution reliability. Chad Rissman and Bill Sanborn will be presenting.
Good morning again, Chad Rissman. Are you on the line, Bill? Oh, not hearing Bill. I guess you just have me this morning. Pretty excited about where we're going with the vegetation management. There are 3 primary objectives that vegetation management, I think, are near and dear to all of our hearts. Steve mentioned one, and that's quartile 1 reliability. The other one is public safety. Trees in the power lines can pose direct public safety-related concerns, but also is one of the leading causes of ignition of wildland fire. So those 3 areas, public safety, quartile 1 reliability, and wildland fire, can all be mitigated with sort of one initiative. That's advancing and improving our vegetation management program. In 2019, we contracted with a consultant who recommended several adjustments to our program. A lot of them are processes and procedural. We're working on a presentation to bring, there's some choices to be made, and we're working on a presentation to bring that forward to the board and talk a little bit more specifically about the details in our vegetation management program. What we're seeking authorization for right now is we're in the 3rd and final year of this contract, 17-78. And we're wanting to, in 2020, to gain some experience of moving in the direction of what our consultant recommends. And I like to call their primary recommendation is for us to increase the volume, but also increase our frequency and move in to a 4-2-1 schedule. So right now we're doing every 3 to 4 years, depending on the area and the growth rate. And then we're going in and looking at areas where we have elevated fire concerns, and we're doing some interim trimming there. What the consultant recommended, we move in a direction of what we're calling a 4-2-1. So it's a 4-cycle every 4 years we would do a trim cycle at a particular area. Every 2 years we would do an interim inspection and trimming of the faster growing sort of deciduous type trees and shrubs. And then we would do an annual inspection, as we're doing, we've started to do here recently, of the elevated fire risk areas. The district has about 1,000 overhead miles of line that would be included in this 421 schedule. And so as we're moving in the direction of the consultant's recommendation, we did increase make recommendations to increase the budget, so this is not a budget increase request for 2020. What we're recognizing is that the majority of the work to be performed related to vegetation management is our tree trimming contractor, which currently is Kemp West. So increasing the authorization of their contract to be able to utilize what's currently budgeted and move us in the direction of 421 schedule is what we're recommending with this field change order number 3. I did want to mention, too, that we're in development of a new contract, so this is the third and final year of this contract. We'll be incorporating some of the recommendations that were made by our consultant who evaluated our vegetation program into the new contract, including an estimate, revised estimates for increased volume in order to achieve this 421 schedule. So this is a little bit of background information. I look forward to bringing back some additional things on the vegetation management side, the program, and some additional choices in terms of what standards we would meet and other things in order to achieve our goals there of a quartile one reliability. So if there's any questions by the board, I'm ready for those.
Commissioners, any questions for Chad?
Gary, this is Randy, and I do have a couple of questions. You know, the longer I'm a commissioner, the more I pay attention to where all our power lines go, and the more I see the trees that interfere in residential areas. Do we have policies by which we prevent trees from getting planted directly under our power lines? And, you know, backyard owners want to beautify. How do we manage through that? Or, and maybe Bill is the more appropriate person to answer this question. He's more closely connected to those details.
That's a great question, and thank you. There's a significant amount of effort that goes into that, but to answer your question, there are no direct policies. We promote something that the Arborist Foundation and the Treeline USA promote, which is this right tree, right place. We like to work with property owners to choose the right type of vegetation. We perform some outreach and communications to customers. Bill and his foresters are oftentimes knocking on doors and requesting coordination and cooperation to plant the sort of right tree, right place underneath the power line. When I mentioned some additional choices about the new standard, there are some recommendations by our consultant to actually determine or identify a specific distance that we would ever want of vegetation to come to be close to our power lines and try to achieve that standard when we're performing this 421. So there'll be some additional conversations and choices around that. But to answer your question again, there's no policy about coordination and cooperation with private and public property owners and agencies. It's a challenge. And we recognize that challenge too is the vegetation oftentimes that are bordering folks' property and on people's property are a personal thing, and they're there for aesthetics and other purposes. So when there's this sort of wildland-urban interface with our utilities, that presents itself a challenge that the right cooperation and coordination and public outreach is needed to navigate through.
I just wanted to jump in and let commissioners know that we do have some information on our website as well. We have a tree planting guide under our plant the right tree in the right place. So if folks are looking for that, they can go to our website first, and it gives them a little bit of a guide to get started with. Just wanted to add that. Thanks.
Say who she is.
And this was highlighted for me this last weekend. I was at my my daughter's home and noticed with their another public utility a cherry tree growing up through the power lines, and I just it didn't look too cool. Looked a little dangerous.
Commissioners, this is Eric. Say, I just wanted to supplement Chad's comments and say the reason that we don't have any specific policies that would mandate or preclude that is because those rights are generally dictated by the nature of the property that we are crossing with our distribution lines and the nature of the rights that we have to be where we are. And to the extent we're in the right of way, we are not the ones who are able to control what can or cannot be planted and might encroach on the right-of-way. That is, whoever owns that particular right-of-way, the municipality would be responsible for restrictions, other than we do have statutory rights to cut and trim that vegetation. The other way we cross property with our lines is, generally speaking, by easement, and the underlying easement documents are what would control what a property owner may do on their property under our lines. You can imagine that we are, over the years, paying closer and closer attention to what property owners are able to do within those easement areas, and our easements today are substantially more restrictive about what use can be put to the property by the owner in those easement areas to ensure that that use, including vegetation, does not interfere with our assets. I will tell you that the vast majority of our easements are quite historic and are less specific and less restrictive about what a property owner may or may not do. So we have to be careful about where we locate our assets and the underlying rights documents that let us site our assets in those locations if we want to control vegetation in those areas.
Thank you, Eric. Appreciate that. Commissioners, any other questions?
Chad, I'd just like for you to speak to one other thing, which is the need for this to be a sustained program versus a peak program.
Ray, I'm learning a lot about that. Vegetation management, nothing that I learned in electrical engineering school. So talking with Bill and the experts and other utilities, getting a better understanding of the need to manage vegetation and how it is an ongoing thing. I see the stats, and we achieve almost a 30% removal. And intuitively, my mind goes to, well, then our program should be reducing over time. So, and there's some more information that'll bring forward to the board, but the volume of vegetation is always increasing. More things are being planted, and we're also having forest health related issues. So this is a sustained year over year. Will be a sustained year over year recommendation to increase budgeting on the vegetation management for those three objectives that we outlined: of public safety, quartile one reliability, and wildland fire. We are looking at, and we'll explore in a little bit greater detail, some efficiencies that we're seeking to gain, because this is a large expenditure year over year. And some of those efficiency gains, including bringing on board some software applications to help improve efficiencies and moving more towards a asset-based or identifying a specific tree rather than a cycle and going out to one area. So being able to target specific trees or specific activities and keep track of what gets removed, we can better understand where we're at in the vegetation, in our vegetation program. So thank you for bringing that up, Steve. This is a significant expense. Vegetation management does provide three very important objectives.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. You know, clearly it's the staff recommendation to proceed with this, but I do want to make sure it's in the right context for the board. So if we were a more normal utility setting rates and didn't have the wholesale revenues that we have, this decision would be about 2% increase on retail rates just by itself because it is a sustained program. Now, essentially what's happening is we will anticipate that we would be allocating a portion of wholesale revenue surpluses to cover this cost that helps us to avoid that retail rate increase, at least for now and for some period of time into the future. But it is a significant decision, and I think it's the right decision. I think it's critical for us in terms of moving towards the higher level of reliability that we want to achieve in addition to the other benefits that Chad has identified. I did want to make sure that the board understand the context of this decision and why it is important. So with that, I turn it back over to the board.
Thank you, Steve. And I can tell you, as one commissioner, being aware of what is happening primarily on the West Coast, where the spotlight has really been turned on with respect to utilities and the potential for starting fires as a result of problems with power lines, it makes a great deal of sense to move forward with Chad's proposal, especially if we just encountered this last weekend, the high winds that roared through our region. And a lot of trees I know have been knocked down. So good presentation, Chad. Thank you. And very timely. Commissioners, any other comments? Steve, I think we're ready to move on to resolution number 8.
Okay, number 8 is a resolution ratifying payment of the 2020 Federal Energy Regulatory Commission administrative annual statements for the Lake Chelan, Rock Island, and Rocky Reach hydroelectric projects, and authorizing the general manager to approve payment of future invoices and advise the board of such amounts. Eric Walquist will be making this presentation.
Thanks, Steve. Commissioners, thank you. So this resolution purports to serve two purposes. First purpose is to ratify the expenditure that was made this year to the for FERC administrative fees, and the second is a request for delegation of that authority to the general manager with a concurrent commitment to report to the board annually what those amounts are. So each year, historically each year, the district budgets for and receives a charge from FERC for annual administrative fees. Those fees are typically due 45 days or so after we receive them, and if they are not made on time, they are subject to a 10% late penalty. We know this as a district. We've been paying them historically, and we budget for them each year. We don't know the precise amount each year until we receive the bill. So this year, on July 15th, we received that bill, and our normal process has both an external review of those fees. We participate, as the board knows, in a cooperative effort. We hire outside consultants to review, as part of this group, the fees that were allocated, and we look for opportunities to correct inaccuracies or to clarify fees that we don't understand. I will tell you that historically that effort has garnered substantially more benefit to the district in terms of reduction and correction of fees than it has cost to the district, and I'm happy to follow up if the board's interested on those issues, although I don't have the numbers with me today. Following the, or concurrent with the external review, is an internal staff review of those fees. And once those reviews are complete, then our typical process is to bring those fees for approval forward as part of the board's consent agenda. Once the board approves those fees as part of its consent agenda at a board meeting, then we process the payment and see that those fees are remitted, or those charges are remitted. So that didn't happen this year. This year, for a number of reasons associated with communication challenges related to COVID and working remotely, complicated by a staff member being on PL, and some of the challenges with how the board meetings happened to fall, we were not able to get those fees and charges onto the consent agenda for approval prior to them being due. I do not want to give the board the impression that we could not have done that. We likely could have. We did not. So when we realized that, we had to make some choices, and we consulted, I did, with Steve, with the department responsible for paying them, and with Stacy Jagla, who is our auditor and statutorily tasked with approving the expenditures, and determined that the best option was to pay them as they are annual, mandatory, and budgeted, and then seek ratification of that payment at today's board meeting. So that is why we were here. That decision was made primarily to avoid incurring the approximate $140,000 of late penalty that would have been assessed had we missed the payment date of August 29th. So we have since then implemented a number of lessons learned opportunities in terms of communications to ensure that we get those things processed and paid timely in the future. That is the first step. The second step or purpose of this resolution is actually one of those opportunities for improvement. In discussing potential resolution of this issue with Stacy Jagla, the auditor, she, to her great credit, raised the question as to whether we had historically ever adopted a resolution delegating the authority to approve and pay those fees to the general manager, because at least in our view, that made a lot of sense, since we know that these fees come every year, and we must pay them in time every year. We were not able to locate that resolution in our search, and it was one of the improvement opportunities that was brought forward, that we could indeed delegate the authority to approve those payments to the general manager. But we still wanted to make sure that there was board and public awareness that those fees were being paid. So the commitment that we are proposing is that once we know those amounts and we get them paid, we will report those amounts to the board in a public session at a board meeting. That should avoid this happening again. That is the end of my presentation, but I am happy to answer any questions that the board has about what occurred and what this resolution would accomplish. I know that Michelle Smith is also on the line, and I want to thank her and her team, including Marty Whiteman, for their efforts in resolving this. They've been very helpful. I know that Michelle could answer any questions if the board has any as well. So I'll turn it to the board, Commissioner Arsenault, for questions.
Thank you, Eric. Commissioners, any questions on this topic for Eric or Michelle?
So, Gary, this is Randy again, and I just want to say, Eric, your explanation was very clear, and I don't have a question about it, but whenever you make a presentation, you always create curiosity questions. And I'm curious what the history of the size of the FERC payment has been over the last 10 years.
So, Commissioner Smith, I think that was also a question that was raised earlier by Commissioner Arsenault, and Michelle Smith has provided that history this morning, and Steve has forwarded it to you this morning, so it is in your inbox okay. For you to review. If you want us to read it for you, we can. If you'd like to go peruse it, it is there for your... and all of the commissioner's information.
Yeah, what I think might be useful is I just looked at those numbers real quickly, and they do bounce around some, and I think it might be helpful if Michelle or Eric could just describe why they vary from year to year.
So, Michelle, I'm going to punt that one to you if you're willing to take it.
Okay. Yes, can you all hear me okay? I want to make sure of that first.
Yes, we can.
Yep. Yes, we
can. Okay, great. Well, and good morning, everybody. Yeah, it's very volatile, and the reason being is that it's basically kind of a two-step process that FERC does every year. So first they guess, so the charges are based on the amount of FERC and federal agency involvement in hydro project relicensings and license activities. So the way that FERC does that is they guess, right now we're paying a bill that's basically a guess by FERC on what, you know, the 2021 year might look like in terms of hydropower license activities. And then what they do is they true that up then next year. We get, that's why you see kind of a true up in those numbers you're going to be reviewing that came in this morning. So basically there are a number of federal agencies that get reimbursed, and including FERC, that get reimbursed for their work on hydropower activities. And the legal effort that Eric was referring to earlier has to do with how, when FERC gets invoices from all of those federal agencies, FERC is required to review them for adequacy and to make sure that they follow the Federal Power Act guidelines for annual charges. And we noticed several decades ago, actually now, that review was not being done very well. So our legal group has been kind of a watchdog, if you will, to make sure that FERC is paying attention to those federal agency invoices, and we have caught mistakes and charges that are getting passed through, and that situation is getting much better. But we have still desire to continue on with that activity until we can come up with a different way of making sure it happens. But I'm not sure if I need to go on anymore, if that helped answer the question.
Michelle, this is Gary, and I have just a real quick question. If you don't know this number off the top of your head, that's fine. Do you know what our share of the Van Ness bill is on an annual basis?
I do. We pay 13%. So there are five licensees now that are part of this group. And I will say that New York Power Authority and Seattle City Light are the two. They carry a bigger chunk of that bill. But we are third at 13%. And it's all based on capacity. So that's why New York Power Authority and Seattle City pay a much larger share.
I see. Okay.
Commissioners, Eric again. Say, I should say that one of the contributing factors to the outcome that we acted upon in terms of paying and then seeking ratification, important, I think, given the conversation you just had, was that that review was completed this year, as it is every year, and there were no abnormalities, air quotes around that, identified that would cause us to appeal. So we felt comfortable by that review that we were paying a bill that would likely not result in additional challenge.
So, Eric, or maybe Michelle, I don't know which one of you want to answer this question. On the adjustment of FERC administrative charge, I'm assuming that's the truing up that you were referring to earlier from the previous year?
So, no, the adjustment, let me just get to one of those so I can see that. That adjustment is not the true up. The adjustment is actually mistakes that Gene Donato or Jody Martin, who review these invoices. Mm-hmm. Many times we realize that FERC either has an incorrect installed capacity number or maybe they just made a mathematical error. So we are very fortunate to have Jean and Jody who review these with a fine-tooth comb. So those are mistakes that they have caught, and we then notify FERC, and they readjust. They adjust our bill.
Thank you.
Commissioner,
one more question, if I could jump in, and that is the other category. It says other federal agency administrative charge. That must be what you referred to earlier as the pass-through from other agencies that FERC then reviews before they send that charge through?
That's correct. So FERC has their own administrative charge, and then we call them OFAs, but the other federal administrative charges is that OFA charge.
And does that flow through to then to the bottom line where it says credits allowed? Does that play into those charges?
Yeah, so I apologize. The credits allowed is actually that amount that is not the true up, but the amount that is any mistake we may have noticed. That's the credits allowed in this case.
Okay. Thank you.
Michelle, this is Ann. So what would you say, I'm just curious, what would be the average true-up, say, in the last couple of years for mistakes made, errors made by FERC?
Yeah, so they're not huge. We, you know, for all three projects, you know, we're looking at, you know, last year we had a true up of 68,000. We noticed that FERC had an incorrect installed capacity number, as I believe was the reason for that one. But historically, FERC, they don't make a lot of mistakes. But I would say that it's, you know, sometimes it's $10,000, and I think $68,000 is probably one of the larger years we've noticed a mistake. But typically, Commissioner, these aren't significant changes or mistakes that FERC is making.
Okay, what would you say? What kind of time commitment does this involve for names? Jody, I forget the two names. Sorry.
Yes, Jody Martin and Jean Sonato. I'm speaking on behalf of them, and I'm not exactly sure how much time they might spend, but I do know that they had in the beginning, so when we first started looking at this, and I'm going to say this was, you know, over 10 years ago, was when Jean actually put in a process of having very effective Excel spreadsheets where he could basically start capturing information like you're seeing, right? And so I know now I believe that they have this process so efficient. I'm guessing it might take them a couple days at least to kind of go through all of this, if maybe not shorter. But they are pretty quick. We normally submit when we receive the invoices, we send them right away to them, and they, we've got, because we have this 45-day turnaround, so we know we need to get analysis going right away. Once they take a look at everything, they typically have an answer back for us that things look, you know, funny or off, or here's their, you know, the results of their analysis, usually within 24 hours. So they're pretty efficient quick at this now.
Interesting. And so this happens every year. You see errors.
Yep.
Every year and time spent.
Wow. We see something every year. Yeah, usually there's something, and sometimes they're so minor that we have to make a decision on whether it's, you know, if it makes sense. Sometimes it's in our favor. So I will say that, you know, there's been, it's kind of a trade-off. There have been years when the mistake has been in our favor. And so then we have to decide, you know, is it worth going to FERC, and then they have to reissue the bill, because the way this works is that FERC has a certain amount of money that they are trying to get recouped through this process. they spread this out to every licensee in the country. And so what happens is if we start changing that amount, they're not going to reissue bills to every licensee in the country. So it's really, you know, every licensee that has a problem with their bill, it's really, you know, it's really a true up on an individual basis more so than the entire licensee group.
Okay. Thanks, Michelle.
You're welcome.
Commissioners, any more questions on the FERC resolution?
Okay, hearing none, I'm going to move on to agenda number 9. Thank you, Michelle and Eric. This is a resolution approving the purchase and sale agreement with Raymond C. Schmitten for the purchase of real property and authorizing the general manager or his designee to complete the transaction. Vicki Griffin, Aline Underwood will be making this presentation.
Good morning, everyone. This is Vicki Griffin, and I believe it's Ian and I will be presenting, unless Aline is jumping on.
So, we got a lot of feedback from someplace. Did someone just come online there?
I think Ian has a little bit of trouble with his feed there. I think that happened last time, too. So, I'll try and answer as many questions as I can, and maybe he can come on when we get to his section, and hopefully that will be cleared up. So we're here today to talk about the Schmitten purchase and sale agreement. We've been working on this with Mr. Schmitten for several years now. This is an area where we currently have a smolt trap that's used to track coho and, sorry, I'm just, the fish part is not my expertise, but we're counting smolts and determining how that plays into our licenses. We're required to, through our HCP plans, to track those things. We are using less than 2 acres of this property for the smolt trap, but when we approached Mr. Schmitten about purchasing the property, I'm sorry, let me back up again. So we're currently in a 10-year lease on the property. Steve Vaughn approached him a couple years ago because we knew the lease was coming up, and he indicated he was selling the property and would not be interested in renewing that lease. So we have been working towards purchasing the property from him during that interim time. When we approached him, we just really wanted to buy the property that we're using for the smolt trap, which is something less than 2 acres. He was strongly opposed to that. And wanted to sell us a larger amount, not less than 7 acres. And the reason for that was because we wanted the waterfront, because that's where our smolt trap is. His preliminary plans were we had 3 lots that were riverfront lots, and he felt like he would be giving up a lot of his ability to make some extra cash on those sales because the lots would no longer be riverfront lots. So we've kind of approached it from that perspective because that's all he was willing to sell us. He was not willing to sell us just the 2 acres for our small trap. So Ian and Aline, I believe, brought this to the board in executive session on February 18th, I believe, just as a heads up that we were working on this. And so since then, we've come to an agreement with Mr. Schmitten, and we signed a purchase and sale agreement a couple of weeks ago. Next slide, please. So the smolt trap and our lease agreement fulfills the obligations for our Rocky Reach and Rock Island licenses. It actually expires in December of 2022. We usually try and start working on those early because, as you're probably aware, real estate deals very rarely go as quickly as we'd like them to go. As I said, he did not want to renew the lease. The other thing that's been recognized is the potential future substation site. So the additional property may be a potential substation site. There has not been any feasibility or public outreach on that. It just happens to be in an area that has been recognized that there may be future use, that there's transmission lines traveling through the property, and it might be a good site for that. But there has been no no additional work done on that to make that determination at this time. The purchase price agreed to with Mr. Schmitten that we're asking to have approved is for $613,000. And this was the appraised value. So we had it appraised as one parcel and not three. I think that's important to note that we didn't, it is not yet developed into three lots. And so we were careful to make sure that the appraisal only appraised the property as it currently exists, not as it would be once Mr. Schmidt did a short plat in it and had three lots, that the value would have been significantly higher had the short plat already been completed. In addition to the $613,000, we have agreed in the purchase sale agreement to share up to $25,000 of road improvement costs. The cap of the district, again, is $25,000 if the city of Cashmere requires road improvements as part of the short plat process. Next slide, please. And I'm going to give Ian a chance here. We'll, hopefully she can get through to talk about the evaluation of alternatives. They went through this process in order to determine whether this was, whether relocating the smolt trap might be a better avenue for us. And he can speak to the evaluation of alternatives.
Thanks, Vicki. This is Ian. Good morning, Commissioners. Mr. Wright. Hopefully I don't have a whole bunch of feedback now. I redialed in through a different means. But as Vicki said, we looked at a bunch of different alternatives. Mr. Schmitten came to us a couple of years ago and let us know that he was interested in selling this property. We immediately started wondering what alternatives we had, and you know, in addition to the possibility of purchasing the property that he was trying to sell. We resurveyed the river. We took a look at historical information from the previous relocation, because prior to being located on the Schmitten property, we were actually connected to the West Monitor Bridge, which is the single-lane bridge located just downstream that's visible there from the highway, Highway 2, as you're passing through. And throughout that initial relocation process, we located a couple of sites that were potential smolt trap location sites if we ever needed them. We went back, took a look at those as alternatives to purchasing the Schmitten property, and a number of the basically the primary primary metrics that we utilized for reviewing these alternatives are the probability of success, our ease of permitting, data continuity, our ease of access, and of course the cost estimate for these options. Primarily the biggest issues that we are looking at having to get over with the alternatives to purchasing the Schmitten property have to do with permitting. The other locations are undeveloped. They would require a tremendous amount of shoreline work, tree removal, and site updates to allow us to even install that trap, and let alone operate that trap going into the future. Maintenance costs associated with the ongoing shoreline maintenance to those sites. It really boiled down to the fact that the Schmitten property comes down to the cheapest alternative for us. That site's already developed. By not having to relocate, we don't lose any of the expense that we've already built into that site. The site works very well for our maintenance crews to come in and set up. There's no flooding hassles like several of these other sites deal with, and there's nothing to permit. We're already permitted. The choice for the staff involved was pretty simple, that purchase of the Schmitten property was really the right way to go. Next slide, please. So I believe I'm not connected through Skype because of the feedback problems I was having, but I believe you're looking at a aerial image of the property, and if that's correct, what's highlighted there in the yellow is the approximate acreage that we were looking to purchase from Mr. Schmitten. And you can actually see our smolt trap if you look close there installed in the river. We occupy and encumber the majority of the shoreline along that riverside of that piece of property that Mr. Schmitten is interested in selling. And one of the reasons he didn't want to reduce the size of this lot is the fact that our presence there really does encumber that lot and takes away a lot of the value of that lot, because we would need to continue occupation of that whole shoreline and prevent anybody else that would come in from behind us to be able to utilize and take advantage of that shoreline. Next slide, please. So as Vicki already mentioned, the PSA is providing us for lease of the orchard back to Mr. Schmidt, and he has verbally announced that he is interested in leasing this property from us post-purchase if this is an approved purchase that we move through. And in addition to Mr. Schmidt, I've had a couple of other agricultural individuals in the area mention that they would be interested in leasing this property from the district as well to further develop and raise pears on that existing ag property. We've got a well maintenance agreement, road maintenance agreement, as Vicki mentioned. The well is just a small domestic well that supplies water to an agricultural house and one other house that's located on the adjacent property post the replatting. And then there's a road maintenance agreement. The road does need some maintenance. Our central maintenance folks have indicated that there's a little bit of improvement that they would like to see regardless of whether or not we own the property. This was a request from about a year ago that they would like to see some maintenance so that our equipment could more easily access to that site. A lot of the brush has grown up and there's some potholes in the road and whatnot. So the road maintenance agreement is very beneficial to our folks as well, and just the overall long-term health of the equipment that's running up and down that road. And the due diligence is already underway. I've got a meeting later this week with the environmental on site to conduct the owner interview and site analysis. We've already done the due diligence for the water rights this and received the information back from that. Next slide, please. Due diligence will be completed by the 25th of September this month. And lastly, the seller's desires to execute this agreement by October 1st. But as Vicki said, the PSA allows us 90 days for the due diligence period to be conducted. And Mr. Schmidt is aware of this. He also has said that completing the short plat on it, which is a requirement that he has to do, is not likely going to be done by October 1st. So he understands that this is a pretty tight timeline and everybody's racing to meet it. But if we can't meet that October 1st timeline, then he's understanding. With that, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to add a couple of additional things that don't think I brought up before, and that is the road maintenance agreement also is an easement. So there's, could you go back to the map, please, Rebecca? So you'll notice the light gray line with the blue dashed line on the southerly side and then up on the west side of the property that we are potentially purchasing. And that's a 30-foot easement for on the bottom for on the south side for Schmidt to. Well, it's our access as well, but it would allow Schmidt to access his property on the west. And then the one that goes north and south is a mutual easement. It would be on our property, but it would allow the improvement to that would allow Schmidt to develop his property, but it also provides, if we did ever use this for a substation site, provides good access to a substation site. The agreement does, however, state that any improvements done to that road are at the cost and at any negotiated amount, but the person who wants to improve that basically bears the cost. So if Mr. Schmidt wants to develop that property for another use, he would bear the cost of improving that road for whatever use he wanted to improve that for. Just as if we wanted to put a substation there, we would be responsible for that as well. the water, there's also 4 acres of Wenatchee Reclamation District water that are provided with the as part of the terms of the sale, and that's been deemed to be adequate to irrigate the orchard during this time. If at some point we decide in the future that we don't need that for substation site, we could also turn around and surplus that if that was in the best interest of the district. Are there any questions about any of this from anyone?
Yeah, hi, this is Gary. I've got a question for you. What is that facility across the river? Is that the sewer treatment facility?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
So we're, the 2 acres that we're utilizing now, where is that on this map?
It's in that the area between, the yeah, right there. So the small trap is in the river?
Yeah, I see the small trap.
Some of us aren't on Skype, so the right there does not help.
I'm sorry. I apologize. On the map, on the lower, in the river, you'll see the smolt trap. And then to up and to the left or to the west of that, there's an area where looks like there's some trucks parked. So we use that for seasonal use in there. But we use all of, pretty much we encumber that whole river area below the light gray with a blue dashed line, the southerly part of that is encumbered by the district for the smolt trap.
Okay, that helps. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So the district has an anchor. There's a cable that runs across the river from the Schmitten property across over to the sewer treatment plant facility, and we have an anchor on that far side that the cable along the right bank anchors to, but there's no access on that side down to the river deep bank.
One more thing that might be of interest to the commissioners and Steve is that if you see the red dot on the map that says approximate location of domestic well, and then there's a house A below that, that's the agricultural housing. And through the terms of the lease agreement, the seller or the lessee would be responsible for all costs associated with the ag housing and the well during the term of the lease. The ag housing probably isn't something we would want to keep, and at some point we'd want to remove that if it was no longer being leased and used for any purpose. But this allows us to plan for that cost at some point in the future when we know that's coming up, as opposed to right now when we're trying to acquire the property.
Commissioners, any thoughts, comments? Personally, for one person, one commissioner, believe that while this was presented to us and it was an executive session, I don't believe our constituents have had a chance to think on this topic, and I would like to see a little soak time here for until our next commission meeting before we voted on this resolution. That's just me. Commissioners, your thoughts?
Gary, I don't think that's an unreasonable request. I mean, this is a somewhat high-profile transaction, and it's one that, you know, the soak time is a good comment.
Commissioners, this is Eric. If that's the desire of the board, that will not interfere with the purchase, and we could bring it back in 2 weeks.
This is Dennis. Yeah, probably be better in 2 weeks.
Then that's what we'll do, Commissioners. We'll put it on the agenda for 2 weeks. Happy to answer any questions in the interim. We'll track any inquiries we get from the public and make sure we let the board know. The only last note that I'd have then is if we are planning to take all of these resolutions with one motion later in the meeting, we'll just try to remember that Resolution 9 would not be included in that motion.
Thank you, Eric.
You're welcome.
Okay, with that, I want to do a couple things. I misjudged how much time we would take this morning, so there may be some folks on the line for manager's items. I'm going to release you. We will not get to those this morning. Ask you to be back on a little after 1 o'clock for because I would expect that we'll get to that fairly quickly in the afternoon session. We do have one item left, item 10. It's possible this might take about 10 minutes or so, depending on how many questions commissioners have. Just want to check, Commissioner Arsenault, with whether you would prefer to start that now or start that after lunch.
Commissioners, what are your wishes on that? We could finish all the resolutions if we could run a little into our lunch hour.
That's fine by me.
Let's do that, Steve.
Okay, this is a resolution authorizing the issuance of a guaranteed maximum price, GMP Amendment Number 2 to Lighted Construction Incorporated of Spokane Valley, Washington, to provide Phase 2 work of the Rocky Reach Central Maintenance Facility Improvements to the General Contractor Construction Manager, GCCM Services, for the Rock Island and Rocky Reach Hydroelectric Support Facility Improvements Project. Casey Hall and Brett Pickford will be presenting. Gentlemen, turn it to you.
Good morning, Commission. This is Casey Hall, Project Manager for the Rocky Reach Facility Projects. So as Steve indicated, I'm here today to present a resolution to amend Lighted Construction's current contract for the Rocky Reach Facility Projects to include a guaranteed max price for construction of central maintenance and the Discovery Center buildings. Rebecca, could you go to slide 2, please? Also today, I'm here to provide an update on the total project budget. So back on August 17th, we came to the commission, gave you an update on where we're at with our budgets for both projects. We've done a lot of work in the last 3 weeks, but we were not able to get to back to the original budget amounts. So I wanted to highlight that today and discuss where we're at with both those projects budget-wise, then break down the GMP amendment and give you the total cost and what the total dollar value is that's on the resolution. And then we can talk about options moving forward for those budget overages on both projects. So back to slide 3, please. So here's Rocky Reach Central Maintenance Facility Project budget. The approved budget originally was $41,500,000. Spent to date is approximately $7.5 million with the Phase 1 work and design effort for Phase 2. Phase 2 construction costs with VE price reductions that we've done over the last 3 weeks since the August 17th board meeting. This includes the 3% owner's contingency and the contractor's contingency that we're required to carry. That gets us to a total dollar value cost of $34,538,435. So the COVID-related costs are also broken out here. They're $418,000. And that brings us the total cost of $42,456,484. So we're over budget by approximately $956,000. Next slide, Rebecca, please, slide 4. This is a summary of the Discovery Center, proof total project budget with the different funding sources, O&M capital, PPB, we are at $7,724,644. Project cost based on VE price reductions since August, the last August board meeting, with the 5% owner's contingency and contractor's contingency, we're at $7,720,344. Our COVID-related costs for CM were $57,623. That's a total of $7,777,967. So we're over budget on that project by approximately $53,000. slide, Rebecca, slide 5. So I wanted to talk about LIHTC's GMP amendment cost. You can see their contract for Rocky Reach broken out into three buckets. The two date that are already in their contract are for their the GCCM pre-construction services for $300,000. And we also have the phase one cost for the site utilities of 3.623409.54. Those are committed. The two that are combined in the resolution for $33,027,823 are the Rocky Reach Phase 2 construction costs and the Discovery Center. And that brings us to a total committed for the GMP, or excuse me, their contract for Rocky Reach would be $36,951,232.54. And that's reflected in the resolution as well. Right, slide number 6, Rebecca. I wanted to talk about the options for the CM budget revision for central maintenance. So we have really have three options moving forward. We can look at, and especially with the work we're doing at Rocky Reach, it's a lot different than what we were doing at Rock Island. Rock Island are new facilities. The majority of the work at CM is remodels. And I, you know, we do the $56,484 and increase the total budget to $42,456,484. The third option for central maintenance, which we talked about back in August, is that we descope. We look at pulling out program. Specifically, we've identified the Riverside buildings, the paint and glass building, the Riverside warehouse buildings. We pull them out of the program and to pull back in our 3% owner's contingency moving forward and remain at our $41.5 million total budget. We've looked at this. I mean, these buildings do provide function to the district and the CM crews. We would eventually need to come back and do these remodels in the future at some point. And we see that cost is going to be more than what the deficit is right now in our budget. So that we see a more than $1 million cost to come back and do this later. I did want to mention on the TCF lighted contributions. TCF has really stepped up over the last 3 weeks to get this project under budget. All the VE work that their design team has done has not increased the fee for their phase one design fee. They've taken that and as part of their original fee. So they've also committed to the district to vigorously manage their construction administration fee and try to and bring it in $100,000 under what we've contracted for that administration work. Rebecca, slide 7.
And I should just say VE is value engineering.
Yes, thank you, Steve, for the clarification. Options for the Discovery Center. We really have two options for that facility. We look at increasing the budget for the COVID-related costs. So this would increase the budget by $53,323,000 and take care of that COVID-related cost. The other option is to look at de-scoping to maintain the owner's contingency and a contractor's contingency. We've already value engineered a lot of the finishes to try to reduce and maintain the same quality, but to get down to that dollar value, we'd have to look at pulling out maybe some of the tile and going with a cheaper product like linoleum, but we wouldn't get that 50-year life cycle out of the project. I also wanted to mention on both of these, from where we were at 3 weeks ago, we were at about $1.9 million over budget on central maintenance and about $300,000 over budget on the Discovery Center. We've reduced that by $1 million on central maintenance and about $250,000 on the Discovery Center. So we've had a lot of work, a lot of time spent on our contractors trying to get us down to budget. Also, LIHTC for the Discovery Center, they've chipped in up there for us. there's a fish wall that's on the entryway that they have donated to the district's about $20,000 worth of work. They're going to do that work at no fee, no cost. They know how important that facility is to our customer owners and people that visit the valley, and they wanted to contribute there. Right. One thing I did want to mention as well, back on slide four, Rebecca, on the Discovery Center project cost, that total budget does include the exhibit cost. We did not look at doing any reductions in or VE value engineering on the exhibits. We are maintaining the full exhibit program that was presented to the board, presented to the commission back in April in the 100% design development documents. So I just wanted to mention that to it. Apologize. Right, slide eight, Rebecca. So our recommendations, staff recommends that we, for the central maintenance,
Casey,
that we...
This is Steve McKenna. Can I ask a question on slide four before we move on?
Sure.
So the budget is over on Rocky Reach Discovery Center by less than what the COVID-related costs are. I just want to make sure I'm clear on that.
Yes, that's correct.
The COVID cost, okay.
Yes, that's correct.
Right? Thank you.
Yep, no problem. Right, so back to slide eight. So our recommendation, staff recommends for central maintenance that a budget revision be made in the amount of $956,484 to cover the COVID-related cost and maintain that 3% contingency moving into construction. For the Discovery Center, we also recommend a budget revision in the amount of $53,323 to cover the COVID-related cost for that project. I also wanted to mention that if the commission decides to approve the budget increases in budgets, this would take place during the 2021 capital budget cycle in December. Slide nine, Rebecca. Staff also recommends issuing a guaranteed maximum price amendment to Lighted Construction for the Phase 2 Central Maintenance and Discovery Center building construction projects. Again, following up on the last discussion, increasing the budgets to absorb that COVID-related cost and keeping that full owner's contingency.
Yeah, I want to add to that for just a moment and say this recommendation does take into account the conversation that the board had at the last meeting and the guidance that was provided to staff. So consistent with Commissioner McKenna's comments, the Discovery Center, if you take into account the COVID-related costs, is within budget. And so this is a budget adjustment that just takes into account the COVID-related costs. On the remaining Rocky Reach facilities, essentially half of the increase is due to COVID-related issues, which leaves us roughly within about 1% of the budget. Our recommendation is for a 1% increase in the budget, we get functionality, which will save us money later. And so we believe that this recommendation is consistent with best for the most for the longest.
Commissioners, are there any questions?
Gary, I would move approval of resolutions 7, 8, and 10.
Okay, it's thank you. Thank you, Randy. It's been moved to approve resolutions 7, 8, and 10. Is there a second?
A second.
It has been seconded. Are there any discussions? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of approving resolution 7, 8, and 10 only, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed, please say no. The ayes have it. It's been approved. Resolution 7, 8, and 10 have been approved.
With that, Commissioner, it's probably a good time for the break. And if the Commissioner would like, I think we could return at 1 o'clock. And we'll finish out the agenda, which are the few items like commission items, et cetera, and then move into manager items.
All right. Commissioners, is that okay if we come back at 1 o'clock?
Yes.
That's going to be 10 minutes shorter than normal. Very good. All right. So we will adjourn, and we will be back here at 1 o'clock. Thank you. Plain County PUD Commission meeting. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in. In the spirit of social distancing due to COVID-19, this meeting is conducted by telephone. Members of the public that may be on the phone who are encouraged to make comment and ask questions. If you do wish to speak, I will be opening the phone lines up later in the business session. If you do wish to speak, please state your name, address for the record, and if you'd be kind enough, please limit your comments to 3 minutes so that all may have an opportunity to speak. We were ahead of schedule and just in front of manager items when we broke for lunch. Steve, would you like to pick it up from here?
Yes, and I did misspeak before lunch and said we'd go to commissioner items, and the agenda does call the manager items first, so I'm prepared to move to that, as Commissioner Arsenault just suggested. So I'd like to start. Tracy Hunt will give an update on the Workers' Compensation Fund. Tracy, are you on?
I am. Thanks, Steve. Hello, everybody. Today I'm here in my capacity as Interim Director of Safety and HPI. So as you know, we are self-insured, and we are required to maintain a workers' compensation fund of $1 million. There's several factors that impact the workers' compensation fund, such as the number and severity of claims that draw down the fund, and then obviously the contribution rate applied to replenish it. As of August 2020, we've had fewer and less severe claims, which is great because it means that more people are going home in as good or better condition than they came to work. The side benefit is that we're able to reduce the rates by about 20% that replenish the fund. And this translates to a savings for the district of about $174,000 per year. We wanted to give you an update, give you some insight about the status of our safety program, and this fund is one indicator of how that program is going. So with that brief update, do you have any questions?
Commissioners, questions for Tracy?
Just a big congratulations to everybody that from top to bottom that's been working on safety is paying dividends.
Well, thank you. I'll pass that along to the rest of the team. I know they're pretty excited about this and many other things that we've been doing, so I'll let them know you had that comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy. Good job.
Okay, next up, Janelle Ulrich will provide an update on Rock Island Early Action Projects. Janelle?
Hi, good afternoon, Commissioners. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thanks.
Wonderful. Janelle Ulrich, Hydro Licensing Manager, with a quick update with the Rock Island Relicensing Early Action. Since we last spoke, we've reached out to each of the four proponents of early action projects. I'll remind you that the City of Rock Island, North Central Washington Audubon Society, the City of Wenatchee, and Chelan County in partnership with the Malaga-Clackam Community Council. And we've reached out to each of those four parties, and we've clarified their scopes. So we're all clear on what we would be doing specifically in those projects. We've also developed memorandums of understanding and sent them out to all of the proponents. We are working on finalizing three of those memorandums of understanding. The fourth one with the Audubon Society has been finalized, and we've even had a kickoff meeting with them and have begun planning efforts to develop a comprehensive Coran area management plan and long-term bird surveys at the Rock Island Pond. So that's the update I have to date on how far we've gotten on early action efforts. Any questions?
Thank you, Janelle. Commissioners, any questions for Janelle?
Janelle, hi, this is Commissioner Congdon.
Yeah, so what was the Rock Island bird counting? I missed that.
Sure, you bet. So part of the North Central Washington Audubon Society, they had a pretty elaborate proposal, and we selected two small pieces of it, one of which is actually they are putting together a long-term bird monitoring program out at the Rock Island Pond. They do something similar and have for years in the Horan area, and they're repeating the equivalent thereof at the Rock Island Pond, and they'll be loading all of the data into a online site called eBird. So we'll be working with them and providing any support along the way to make sure they have what they need to get those surveys in place and that they have continued success over the years collecting data.
Well, that's terrific. Oh, good. Thanks.
You bet.
Any other commissioners have questions for Janelle? Well, good job, Janelle. I know that the participants are all kind of eager to move forward, so I appreciate you working with them and keeping them in the loop.
Thank you.
All right, next up, we've got the scheduled closure of the Loop Trail. Brian Baker will be speaking to that.
Hey, good morning, commissioners. Ryan Baker, Parks Manager. Can you guys hear me okay?
Sure can. Thanks.
Fantastic. Well, I wanted to provide an update on two sizable park projects, as Steve mentioned, that one has to do with closing the Loop Trail. But maybe I'll start first with the Confluence State Park boat launch. The work there is planned to start October 5th and run through October 30th. What we're going to be doing at that location is replacing bolt ramps with a new concrete rail system. Other launches will be available on the pool at that time, including Riverfront and Kirby Billingsley Hydro Park. No need to replace the floats as part of this project, as State Parks did so about 5 years ago. So a great example of a partnership on fixing the entire launch and floats in that particular location. Moving along to the second project I wanted to brief you on, and that is a Confluence State Park erosion project. That project is scheduled to start as early as September 21st and run all the way through November 10th. That's what we're looking like for a completion date. It is a bank stabilization project, and it is located north of the boat launch and just east of the restroom of the Apple Capital Loop Trail. As Steve mentioned, the Apple Capital Loop Trail will need to be closed for safety purposes. We'll have a lot of construction equipment in there, moving back and forth, and we just want to make sure that folks using the trail have a safe way to pass through. So we will be sending out a pretty sizable plan for a detour, and the detour will start as far north as the Otabastian Bridge and then ultimately end up at the entrance of Confluence State Park. So again, we'll have placards out there, we'll have signage, but we just want to ask for folks to certainly have patience while we get in and stabilize the shoreline there. So those are the two projects I was providing an update on. Any questions?
Commissioners, questions?
Gary, this is Commissioner Smith. I don't really have a question. I just have a comment about it. Last week, my wife and I had family here from Chicago, and we took the occasion to walk the trail down in Wenatchee from Hybus up to Fifth Street and a little bit beyond, and first time our family had been there, and they were just absolutely in awe of not only what I love, the flowers and all of the planting, but they love the artwork that's there too, which I have to admit I probably didn't appreciate as much before I went on that walk with them as I do now. So just thank you to their entire staff for the beautiful care you take of what we have down there.
Fantastic. Thank you for those comments, and I absolutely will share that with our staff as well as our partners that we work in that area. What a special place.
It is.
If I can, I'd like to piggyback on what Commissioner Smith just said. Recently was spending a couple of days at an RV park up in Anacortes, and a gentleman from Sacramento with a similar coach to mine was talking with me, and somehow the conversation got to Wenatchee, and from Wenatchee it got to Confluence Park, and from Confluence it got to all the trail system, and could not believe the how fabulous our trail system was, how well maintained and manicured it was, and thought that it belonged to the state. And of course I had to correct him. And anyway, I just want you to know that that's not the first time. I previously had run into somebody from Texas who makes a point of coming up and staying at Confluence and walking our trails into town. The word's getting out all over. So you guys do a great job, and it is noticed, and it is talked about all throughout at least Washington when I run into these folks. So good job.
Thank you, Commissioner, and it's nice to get some compliments as we've had a pretty busy park system so far with COVID. So I absolutely will share those thoughts with our staff. So thank you.
Okay, with that, thank you, Ryan, and we'll move on to our next item. Andrew Grissel is going to give an update on a few energy efficiency efforts that I think are worthy of mention to the board.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Andrew Grissel, I manage our energy development conservation team. And first one is a document that I sent out is a briefing on our agricultural sector, and it's called SEM Light, and SEM stands for Strategic Energy Management. And what this is a holistic look at a facility. We've had some good success working with Confluence Health the last couple of years, and we wanted to move this program into the agricultural sector because we thought at some of the facilities there would be some good opportunities there. And what it does is it looks from a high level, and we work with a consulting company, Cascade Energy, to go into these sites and look at the whole facility. And then what happens is we get together, they go through the facility, they identify a number of items, either no cost, they can be low cost, or they can be capital items. And then we discuss with them, and we put together a plan with the facility operators. And then there's kind of there's a path divergence. There's either just some tune-ups, which if, you know, the tune-up is putting set points in a more efficient position, whereas custom projects might be adding a variable frequency drive to one of the systems. And so there can be a couple different paths that get taken, sometimes both at one facility. And then we come back together, put all those items together, and put together a package and a project. And it's really been cost effective for us. Our benefit cost ratio for this program across the board has been about 3.8 BC ratio. This year we're targeting 0.6 average megawatts of savings with our ag partners. And if you look down through the on the documents, you can look at how much that is for our portfolio savings, where you see that SEM red on that first section of graph. The red is a portion of that commercial industrial. It's a big portion of our savings. We have projects going into next year also. And then on the last page, I provided a summary of a example of one of the sites. We worked with Chelan Fruit. Big savings, about almost just over half an average megawatt of savings. We've been working on this since the fall of 2019 till present. And you've seen the number of examples of no-cost, low-cost, and capital projects that we've been working with them on. Highly successful. We'll be continuing to work on this project, this program with our other facilities. We have some lined up. And we're also moving it into other areas. So we're taking this model, and we're in conversations with the city of Wenatchee on the water wastewater treatment plant. And so, you know, again, going in, that same process, going in, looking at the whole facility, identifying either
set points, making things run more efficient, or are there actual capital projects that we can help support and fund as well through our rebate programs? And so that's sort of moving it into that next level. You know, many of the programs that we have on there are, or any, many of the projects, there are CO2 scrubbers, especially at the fruit facilities, there are CO2 scrubbers. We get a lot of savings from variable frequency drives on compressors. From the tune-up perspective and low cost, just set points on the drive, the motors, the activities. And then, you know, if there's associated with a cooling facility, fast-acting doors provide us with savings. And then, you know, lighting. We still continue to have lighting projects and are working on helping to light the facilities more efficiently. So on that, for that one, is there any questions?
Any commissioners, any questions for Andrew? Andrew, let me say that I think you must have a pretty fun job being able to be so creative and take a look at the cutting-edge technologies that are able to conserve power and energy. And it's kind of like you've got a job that everybody's glad to see you coming in the door because you're going to help save them some money. So it's a win-win. I really appreciate what you do for the district.
Thank you. And, yeah, we have just a great team that's always out there doing a scan of the environment, looking at what the technology, will it work here? Sometimes we have to wait a little longer because we don't think it's quite mature enough. But, yeah, it's a great team, great group to work with. It's always fun to be able to go and help our customers and the other employers within the county to operate more efficiently so that they can, you know, use those funds in other places. So, yeah, it's great. I'll move on quickly to the next one. I just wanted to let you know that in case you're out there and you see marketing campaign, we're putting a focus on what we call our Simple Steps lighting program. And this was this is where we worked with a third party to buy down the cost of efficient lighting at the point of purchase. So at, you know, going into a store, it's already, the price is already down, so there's nothing else you have to do. This was an extremely cost-effective program for us that will be coming to an end. This is a regional project, and one of the major funders is not funding the program anymore because really the savings for these are dropping over time. And so as more efficient lights get put in, you know, the next crop of lights is less efficient. And for them, it's not, you know, they're not seeing that value, whereas we continue to see value there and would have liked for it to continue on, but we're going to look at other ways to maybe do something within our community with just on a smaller scale. But the slide that I put in the packet, it's called EE Marketing Focus, Simple Steps Lighting, and it was really interesting in that because we knew this was coming to an end, we were really looking at hitting it and trying to get as much savings out of the program as we could before it does come to an end. And it just goes to show how when you really get all the marketing resources going in the same direction, what happens? And so the first graph is the traffic to our lighting pages at our website. We can see it's an all-time high. We're typically at around 150 visits a month, and this was in August data. We had over 750 visits to the lighting pages. The second graph is split out by weeks or days and weeks, and we can see that the channels that we can take the data that we can capture from our marketing campaigns to see what's working, and we can see which channels are bringing people to the lighting pages. And so Lightly, which is a blog that we do on energy efficiency and other things of interest, is, you know, it was sent and it really pushed, got a big push early on. And then we also have social media campaigns that we do across all of the different formats, and you can see that we had over a 70% increase in traffic since those were started. And so bottom line is we're increasing our customer media insights from the lighting campaign. Now we're excited to see how that translates into uptake of numbers next month. You know, we have a baseline that we can look at, and, you know, we'll see how this works. And then we do that with each of our programs. You know, it's just an insight into a little bit of how when we pick one of our programs to market, how do we look at it? How do we market it? What kind of data do we use, and how does that data then influence us into the next steps that we take?
Andy, this is Ann, Commissioner Congdon.
Yes.
Wow, very innovative. Good job. Great work. I love hearing about it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll pass that along. And I have just two other quick ones that kind of popped up as we were between getting information out and today. One is we've been working really hard to get virtual audits out to our community, and we are starting the first ones this week. So we're very excited about that. The team put a lot of effort, a lot of thought into how we can go about doing that. And so we're real excited about having those virtual home audits. You know, we've been getting, you know, questions about, you know, we continue to get questions from customers on how they can, you know, make their homes more efficient. So this is a great tool to help us do that. And then we're also opening up the Sahikan virtual open house this week. And so we talked about that about a month and a half ago. We've been working really hard on getting the right information on that virtual open house. And so we'll be starting that up, and that'll be open through the end of September. And we're asking for customers to provide us with comments until that point. And then we'll put those comments all together and bring those back to the board. So those were the other two items that I had. So any questions on any of those?
This is Ann again. Can you tell me a little more about the Sahikan virtual open house?
Yes, it's web page driven, and it's putting together information that we've been sharing with the board over the last several months into a location that normally when you go to an in-person open house, you have kind of your sections that you walk through. And so you might walk through a background section, you might walk through a solution section. And so this virtual open house is in a web page form that you can kind of walk yourself through. A customer can walk themselves through in a manner that is similar to how you would walk through in person. And so we start out with the background. Then we start out with the challenge. What do we see up there? The demand. You know, we're having, you know, the challenges with the, you know, in the future of meeting demand. Then we have, well, what are some of the solutions that we're looking at? Here are some of those. And then we have a kind of a conclusionary area with frequently asked questions, with a section for that we have, you know, a place for comments from the customers. And so just as we would in person have those things, it's like that. And there will be a link, and we'll get that sent out to the board too, so that the board can look at that as well.
Yeah. So Andrew, how can people access this?
The plan is that we are going to be sending out emails as well as other communication forms to customers, and we'll send those to the board as well. And there'll be a link, and customers can click on the link to go to that to go to the site where it's being hosted, and then customers and others can walk themselves through the information. And there's always contact information from us if people have more detailed questions. They can call us and we can talk to them. And so the access will be through a link that we will be sending out to customers through various forms of the communications channel that we have with them.
Oh, terrific. Thank you.
Welcome. Those are the items that I have.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
So next up, Tika Sellers is going to describe for us some additional outreach that we're doing on planned outages.
Yeah, good afternoon, Commissioners. This is Tika Sellers, Customer Outreach Specialist with Customer Utilities. So we normally make phone calls for planned outages about 2 days in advance. And lately, we've been noticing that obviously we were having some concerns about folks working from home, schooling from home, and those planned outages and the impacts that they're having. So I believe that you've seen a copy of the postcard that will go out later this week. We'll also be sending an email. We have
about 57% of our customers, residential customers for whom we have email addresses for, so we'll send something out via Constant Contact. And the main message here is to let folks know that we do understand their concerns, but we appreciate their understanding and knowing that we need to continue planned maintenance, because if we don't, then it could lead to unplanned outages later on. So in the postcard, we give them some tips on how they can best prepare for those. We suggest that they make sure we have their most current contact information. We let them know that they can find the Wi-Fi hotspots on our website. We're also communicating with local school districts, so we've offered to put the school districts on our outage notification email so that they know when an outage is going to happen in their area in case students or parents call with concerns about that. So we just wanted to let you know that that's going to be going out to all of our residential customers, which is about 39,000 folks. And we did do a radio spot this morning on Coho and Cozy, and we may be doing some social postings as well. So just trying to be proactive in communicating our need and our empathy there. And that's
very
all
good.
I have.
Thanks, Tika. Very good.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is Steve McKenna. I looked at the card and thought they were well done and really appreciate the efforts to communicate to parents and community members about those possible outages, and particularly today when people are, you know, just everybody's working home. And
yep.
So it's understand. Really important for good communication. I just want to let you know how much I appreciated those efforts.
Yeah, absolutely. And just wanted to let you folks know that Rachel Hansen, Sarah Delosier, and Jenna Rahm and I all worked on this together. So it was a group effort, and it has been run through a few different channels just to make sure that everything we were saying was accurate and useful and got our main points out there to folks. That's all I had, unless anybody has any other questions or comments.
Thank you, Tika. A couple other items. Let me do one first. So per the discussion with the board at the last meeting, the COVID-19 numbers are provided in your book. We did not see anything that looked significant enough for extended discussion here. I would just say that the amounts of overdue balances have actually gone down since the last board meeting. And so we continue to watch to see if there is anything that would suggest a need for further board discussion. With that, we'd like to turn to a pressing issue. We've had a lot of fires in the last 24 hours that have come up, and hopefully Chad Bowman is on the line and can provide an update on the array of ways that has potentially impacted the PUD.
I am here. Thanks, Steve. Chad Bowman, Director of Transmission. Might start with some of the things that are mostly resolved that we've dealt with in the last day or so. Chief Joe, interestingly enough, tripped offline entirely yesterday afternoon for reasons that aren't entirely clear to us. Probably somewhat fire-related. There must be something more there. So as well, how that impacted us really is the telemetry values that we get from Chief Joe either froze or went to zero. So there was a lot of uncertainty yesterday afternoon predicting river flows, associated generation requests, and really wondering if we might have enough water depending on how long this went on. So there's a lot of really good coordination yesterday afternoon, yesterday evening, EP&T folks, system operations folks, with participants, with PowerX, and fortunately, Chief Joe came back online yesterday evening and appears to be mostly back to normal. Next, the next thing that's mostly resolved, probably aware of the Apple Acres fire north of the Chelan Airport. As usual, the line crews working that area coordinated closely with the fire folks on the ground. A couple of comments from folks this morning about the great job they did protecting a pumping facility that aided some of those firefighting efforts. Yesterday evening, that fire moved up and away from our facilities. Last I had heard, there was maybe four distribution poles in that area that needed replacing. And I see on social media that they're saying that fire is about 70% contained. The issue that is causing us a bit of concern right now that doesn't have a resolution as of yet, and not quite sure where we're going to go with this yet, is the Schlan service area. Schlan, Manson, Wapato, everybody is in service. And we find ourselves really in a somewhat awkward position of where our customers are in service. I think as today has gone on, more and more utilities in the Northwest are realizing the extent of damage in their system, both in Eastern Washington and Western Washington. I just saw something from a Portland General that looked pretty significant, but only Chelan is fed by three transmission lines, and we like to have a great deal of redundancy there to make sure those customers remain in service. You might remember some of this discussion from the surge tank planning we did a few years back. Currently, we're down to a single contingency. There's one transmission line feeding the Chelan area. It's the Rocky Reach Chelan number 2 line that's on the Chelan County side. Unlike the surge tank outage, due to the time of year and the lower loads, we're not concerned with the loading of that line, and that we think that line can provide service to that area as long as it remains in service. The other two lines, Chelan Stratford, that's an Avista-owned line, went out of service yesterday morning. Got a report, a very brief report from Avista just before noon today. Fire crews weren't allowing anybody access into that area yesterday or this morning, but they're very brief report, and, you know, in a lot of these situations, initial reports are often wrong or incorrect, or they might be right. It's just hard to tell. But their initial report is there could be miles of burnt-off poles and wire on the ground. They don't have an ETR as of yet. One of our folks is also working to gain some access up there to get some eyes on it, and have not heard back from them yet. The other line, the Rocky Reach Chelan number 1 line, which is on the Douglas County side, Douglas is in the middle of rebuilding that line per the McNeil Canyon agreement. So that line is, I think they're about 2 weeks into a three-month rebuild program. So we've been talking to Douglas yesterday, today, about what it might take to restore that line to service. We're thinking it might be 3 to 5 days to put that line back in service, although that could be, mentioned that awkward situation at the beginning, right? It could be resource constrained in terms of being able to find somebody to do that work with so many other problems going on in the Washington and the Northwest due to fires. We did provide a heads up yesterday to some key folks in Chelan. I think Steve and Justin talked to the mayor of Chelan, Chelan County Commissioner Doug England. We made sure the local fire is kind of aware of the situation in the Chelan area. And this morning brought the irrigation districts, both Lake Chelan and Greater Wenatchee, up to speed on our service concerns in that area. Just not that there's really anything that we're asking them to do, but want them to be aware of our concerns if there's something that they might be doing to prepare for a potential outage. So I'll stop there and see if you have any questions.
Commissioners, any questions?
No?
Chad, I don't have a question, but I do have a comment, and that is that yesterday was really a wild day. I don't know how much sleep you got last night, but you sound pretty good, pretty bright-eyed and chippered, so I don't know how you do it. But thank you for doing it. Appreciate it.
Appreciate that. There are a lot of good folks working on this, and it mostly kind of stabilized around 9 o'clock yesterday, so that was great.
You know, I just want to add that, you know, we are operating with more risk than we're accustomed to right now, and just to reinforce the point that Chad made, probably not a lot we can do to change this right now. You've got people who are out of power. They're going to be the priority of someone who's at risk of being out of power, and there's going to be a high demand for crews and poles all the way across eastern Washington for the next week or two. So it's pretty much a risk that we're going to have to live with. With that, that concludes our manager items for today.
Okay, well then I guess we'll move on to commission items. Commissioners, I have it on good authority that we have a proposed motion. Would a commissioner wish to make that motion? This is for the board workshop.
Mr. President, this is Commissioner Smith. I would move to set a special meeting on Friday, October 9, 2020, at 9 a.m. to be held virtually for the purpose of holding a fall board workshop. Virtual meeting information will be posted on the PUD website.
Thank you, Commissioner Smith. The motion has been made. Is there a second?
Second?
I'll second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion on the date and time for the board workshop? All those in favor of the proposed motion, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay, and the ayes have it. Are there any other commission items at this time? Hearing none, we shall move on to commission travel.
And with that, Lisa Sanders has appropriately walked in the door at exactly the right moment. So welcome, Lisa.
Thanks. Hello, commissioners. We don't have much to update today. In fact, I've only made a couple registrations for one for Commissioner Arsenault for the Cybersecurity Virtual Summit, and Commissioner Bowles is registered for the September WAPUTA meetings. Everything has stayed the same. We don't have any rooms held. Would anyone else like to be registered for September meetings?
I would. I'll be going to all of them. Well, just about all of them.
So we have September 16 to 18 and September 30 to October 2nd, the water workshop.
I will not be doing water. I'll be doing the other.
Okay. Thank you.
Lisa,
I'll be. Oh, go ahead. Dennis? Yeah, am I registered? I'm sorry. This is Ann Congdon. Am I registered for Water Workshop?
No, I will do that.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Lisa, this is Dennis. I will not be going to the Water Workshop.
Thank you.
So this is Steve. I will not be doing water workshop, but you can go ahead and register me for WAPUTA.
Okay, thank you.
And Lisa, I will be going to the October 15th, or virtually going to the Budget Committee meeting for WAPUTA.
Okay. How about...
the November.
I will also.
Oh, okay. Commissioner Smith got that.
Right.
And Commissioner Arsenault? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Commissioner Bowles will not go to the budget workshop.
You are or are not?
Will not.
Okay.
And Lisa, the November 18-20 WAPUTA meeting, I will be attending that.
Okay. Then what about, and are you attending the water workshop or just Commissioner Congdon?
I will not be attending the water workshop.
Okay. Commissioner Congdon, do you want to be signed up for the September WAPUTA meetings? The 16 to 18? Commissioner Congdon?
I'm sorry. I didn't mute. I'm sorry. Here we go. I'm looking at my calendar, and I am not available the 16th, but I'd like to be signed up for 17th. Is the board meeting on the 18th, or do they consolidate everything onto Thursday the 17th?
I'm not sure what the agenda board is.
Board meeting is on the 18th.
Okay. Yeah, so go ahead and sign me up. The only thing I'll miss is the round table.
Okay. And is anyone, I think just Commissioner Smith would attend the APPA fall board meeting?
I think that's by invitation only, and I'm on the board. So.
Okay. And then for October budget meeting, just Commissioner Arsenault and Commissioner Smith?
Correct.
Okay.
Lisa, this is Steve. You can go ahead and put me down for the November WAPUTA meeting, though.
Okay.
Same with Randy.
And Anne.
Okay.
And Dennis.
Thank you. Anything else?
Just a question for the Education Committee roundtable on the 16th of September. Who all is going to be involved in that?
Is that for Commissioner Smith?
No, that was a generic question. I think Steve McKenna has been active on that the last several months. Am I right, Steve?
Yes.
You'll do the report.
I believe I can.
Okay, because I was just checking to see who was going to do the report. Perfect.
Commissioner Arsenault, do you want
Dennis,
to be... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Dennis, are you planning on attending on the 16th?
Yes.
I would rather have you do the report, if you wouldn't mind.
I could do it, unless Commissioner Arsenault is going to be there.
No, I would defer to either one of you, if you so desire.
Well, I can do it.
Thank you, Dennis.
Yeah, thank you. That helps me out, Dennis.
All right.
And Commissioner Arsenault, do you want to be registered for November WAPUTA meetings? Or are we holding off?
No, go ahead and register me for that.
Okay, thank you. All right, I think we're set for the next couple months then. Unless there's something else I can do for you.
I think that's pretty good. Thanks, Lisa. Little did you know there'd be so much work to do today. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
You know, commissioners, I would like to just offer one other thought. I didn't, thinking about the Education Committee, I'm not sure that we have reported to you how much we've done with the STEM network, the Washington State STEM network. They did originally were going to have their conference here in Wenatchee, and we had signed up to support that and recruited a number of other utilities to support it as well to put together kits about hydropower that teachers could use in their classrooms. That conference went on virtually, and there was material was described to the teachers and has been provided to them. I'm not sure if that fits in terms of your discussions at the Education Committee. We intend to continue this effort into the future and continue to look for partners that would like to join with us to get more information into the classrooms around the value of hydropower.
Okay.
So, Gary, along other commissioner items and along the what I would call a different educational line, I know it came out to all of us last week or the week before, but our Hydro Research Institute really passed a great milestone this past couple of weeks in landing the third member of the board of directors in the New York Power Authority. And I know it got reported, but we haven't talked about it at our commission meeting. And, you know, I sent a text to Steve and Kirk Hudson with big kudos, because long term this could mean a lot for hydropower, not just here but actually all over the world, if it takes off the way it could.
So thank you, Commissioner Smith. We are very pleased with that. There will be a formal press release coming out, we think, later this week that will make that an announcement, although both Gil Quinones, who's the CEO for New York Power Authority, and I spoke to it at the National Hydropower Association Hydropower Day last week. So the word has filtered out that in fact that has happened. And in addition, we are planning a presentation for the board. We've continued to pursue a patent on a particular technology, and we wanted to provide the board an update on that. That's the work that John Yale has been leading for us. So we're going to package a few things together and bring them to you either the next board meeting or the board meeting following that. Okay, if there's nothing else there, I get to a delegation of action items. We had a couple from the last meeting. There was a request from Commissioner Smith to get some more detail about the unemployment numbers. I believe we satisfied that request. Is that correct, Commissioner Smith?
You did. Thank you very much.
Okay. And then there was a request, actually this goes back to a couple of meetings ago, from Commissioner Arsenault to connect with Eric regarding the local improvement district bonds. And my understanding is that one is complete as well. Is that correct, Commissioner Arsenault?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
And that's all we had for open action items.
Okay. Well, and delegation items from today?
Just have one. Andrew Grissel will share the Stehekin Virtual Open House website with the commissioners. Did we miss anything?
I think that was it. Okay, so at this point, any other news for the good of the order? Any commissioners' comments? If not, we will move on to an invitation of public comment. Any member of the public that might be on the phone and wish to make a comment and or ask questions, I will open the phone lines up now. If you do wish to speak, please state your name, your address for the record, and please be kind enough to limit your comments to 3 minutes. Rebecca, would you please open the phone lines up for anyone that wishes to comment? Hearing no comment, we will move on the agenda. We have a need for executive session, I understand. 90 minutes, Steve?
Yes, please.
Okay. So we will be moving into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement action, litigation, potential litigation, to which the board or to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by RCW. So 90 minutes, and we will be calling back in on the other phone number. So we will adjourn until we come out of executive session. September 8, 2020, no decisions were made, no votes were taken. Business to come before the commission. Hearing none, we shall stand adjourned.